All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Jeff Mieliff, and I'm a senior program manager in the Exchange product group. I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to have this opportunity to talk to you about Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2 today. We're going to be going through some content that talks a little bit about kind of the hows and whys around how we create service packs. The decisions that we make around what goes into a service pack versus update rollups, and we're gonna talk through the four primary new features that we released in Exchange Service Pack 2, and then we'll talk briefly at the end of the session about one of the newer items in the latest update rollup that we just released a few weeks ago, and kind of describe how we actually make the decisions around what goes into update rollups. Versus the service pack features. So first of all, before we get started here, how many of you are actually running Service Pack 2 today? Hopefully most of you. Okay, great. So some of this may be review. I do want to make sure that, you know, you have a good understanding of what these new features are that we brought out in the release, why we added them, and make sure that you have enough information to actually be able to take full advantage of the changes and investments that we made. We are going to spend a fair amount of time talking about address book policies. So hopefully that's of interest to you. That is a feature that we've gotten a lot of feedback on from customers, and very positive feedback in terms of addressing very important customer needs, both around hosting scenarios as well as around address book segmentation scenarios. Do we have any hosters in the room, commercial hosters who are actually running Exchange for other organizations? Okay, a few. I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about our strategy and some of the changes that we've made in Service Pack 2 with regards to Exchange 2010 hosting and our recommendations and guidance about the best way to do that. Before we move on, I'd like to apologize for the lack of internet. I have nothing to do with it. I have no further information. I understand that it's painful, certainly at a technology conference, to not be as connected as we'd like to be, but it is what it is at the moment. I know there's a lot of people working on trying to get it up and running as quickly as possible. So to start off with, so Exchange is an extremely complex product. I've been working on the Exchange engineering team for about 12 years, both in a development role, a test role, and a program management role. I've worn all three of those hats. And in that time period, I've spent time in different component areas and different areas of focus and been able to actually work with a lot of different pieces of the product. But one of the things that I like about Exchange is that it's so big, that it's so broad, that there's always something new to learn. So from a development perspective, we have about 20 million lines of code that we maintain. A very significant portion of that, more than half of it, is actually test code that we run every day on every build of the product to make sure that our quality remains as high as it possibly can be. We actually have some automated processes in place where every time a developer makes a change in our product, we actually are able to go through the thousands of tests that we've written for the product, figure out which ones of those tests are actually relevant to the change that the developer made, and run those tests automatically before the developer can even check that code in and commit it to our source code. And then in addition to that, every day we basically run an entire test pass on a set of what we call kind of common topologies, topologies that represent the way you most likely are deploying Exchange. We certainly do find that bugs creep into the product. Every piece of software has bugs. There's really no way around that. Our goal is really to minimize them and make sure that the bugs that we find are the least impactful bugs possible. And I think it's fair to say, in my experience, the bugs that I usually hear about from customers are issues that come into play because of deployments that are not exactly the way we deploy in our test labs. And we're always interested in that feedback and understanding, those scenarios that we've missed from our quality assurance process so that we can constantly go back and improve that. So Service Pack 2 was released about 6 months ago. What we're talking about today is not brand new, fresh news. But we do continue to provide additional releases once we provide a service pack to our customers, and we call those update roll-ups. We've released three of those on a fairly regular frequency since Service Pack 2 was released. So service packs for Exchange are about two things: fixing bugs that our customers have reported or that we've found internally, either through our testing processes or, frankly, issues that we found in our own online service. We have hundreds of millions of mailboxes today in Exchange Online, part of Office 365, and that's actually a great way for us to get feedback into our engineering team about product issues. And so we use that feedback from the online service as a way to actually improve the on-premises product that you deploy today. So we're constantly going through and fixing those issues, and we're also adding features and service packs, primarily based on feedback from our customers and our partners and our field. Anyone happen to know the reason that we don't release features in update rollups? So the reason for that is that service packs are really the only place that we can update the Active Directory schema. And typically, when we come out with a new feature, you want to be able to turn it on and off. We don't want to give you a feature that, you know, maybe adds some new functionality for your end users that you have no control over. We want our Exchange administrators to be in control of what that user experience is. So in order to actually be able to store those attributes, the ability to turn things on and off, we have to update the Active Directory schema. And we do that as part of our Service Pack installer. We don't have the ability to do that with our update rollups. So that's why you typically see features coming out in Service Packs. In Service Pack 2, we fixed about 600 bugs, give or take. Some of those are specifically documented in the release notes on the web for Service Pack 2. Some of them aren't. There's, you know, a number of issues that we fix frequently in these releases where we don't specifically call out the issue. They're, you know, small contained fixes that, for the most part, are very specific to a customer or maybe a small group of customers. So, you know, going into a great detail in our documentation doesn't make sense. We do go through a very interesting process when we decide what we're going to fix and what we're not. Anyone who's spent time in software engineering knows that, you know, every fix that you make or every change that you make to a software product has risk associated with it. There's a lot of very old code in Exchange, right? That store.exe process that is effectively sort of the database engine of Exchange, you know, it sits on top of the extensible storage engine, JET, and actually provides the business logic for our database. That code has been around for a very long time. And any code that's been around for a very long time is risky to change. So we're constantly making decisions around the risk of making a change, the benefit to our customers of making that change, and the pain that people are feeling. So we want to fix the things that make the most sense to fix that are going to have the greatest benefit, but we don't fix everything. And as I point out here on the slide, sometimes we have bugs that just make us look stupid, frankly. And sometimes we don't fix those, and that's the right decision. So for those of you that have escalated issues into our support organization and into the product team, you may have had that experience where a fix has been rejected. In general, we do that when there's a good workaround for that issue, where, you know, we can help you solve the problem in another way without actually taking that risk of checking in a fix to the product. So with that, I'm going to jump into talking about some of the new features in the product. I am going to have some time at the end for questions. And in addition, if we don't get to your questions or if you don't want to ask in this forum, I will be in the booth on the show floor every day this week, including right after this session. So feel free to stop by. More than happy to answer any questions you have about Exchange 2010. So to start off with, the mini version of Outlook web app. So how many of you are familiar with Outlook Mobile Access that was in Exchange 2003? A few of you? Okay. For those of you, this will look very similar. This is not OMA. This is OWA Mini. Unfortunately, just to confuse you a little bit, if you actually look at the URL up there, OMA is in the URL. And actually, if you had access to the Exchange source code to go look at this, the term OMA is all over the source code as well. But this is not OMA. It's a totally different implementation, effectively for the same purpose. So the goal here is really about addressing a need in one particular market of the world where we see a lot of deployment of cell phone-based browsers for accessing email. Not a lot of people actually using ActiveSync in that particular market to sync down email to their devices and read it in sort of a cached storage mode. Instead, they like to use browsers on their mobile devices and access an interface like this. Anyone know what that market is? Japan. Yep, that's exactly right. Having said that, this is actually a very useful thing outside of Japan. I've found myself using this a couple of times when I've had ActiveSync issues on my own device and needed to get something quickly without troubleshooting that ActiveSync issue. The feature is actually enabled by default. It's turned on once you install Service Pack 2. Your users can get to it. You have the ability to turn it off, and I'll describe how that works in just a minute. But the major difference between this implementation and what we had in Exchange 2003 with OMA is that this is actually built on Outlook Web App. It's the same code base. So all the features and all the languages and all the types of content that you can access with OWA, you can get to through OWA Mini. With OMA, that wasn't the case. OMA was totally separate application, separate set of supported languages, and separate set of limitations in terms of what you could and could not do with that tool. With OWA Mini, you basically get whatever is available in OWA through this mini interface. It's just you can sort of think of it as a theme for OWA that provides this very limited view, or very slimmed down view. So in terms of managing it, how do we manage it? Well, we can certainly turn it on or off, and that's done via OWA mailbox policies, because this is part of OWA. And we added an OWA mini-enabled attribute on the set OWA mailbox policy commandlet to be able to enable this or disable this. The other key thing to remember here is that if you actually are segmenting OWA functionality today, so maybe turning on or off the calendar functionality within OWA, or the ability to use tasks, or any other limitation that you can put into place using OWA mailbox policy, those actually flow through to OWA Mini with no other changes necessary. If you have an OWA mailbox policy that applies to a user and limits their ability to do something in OWA, it will limit their ability to do the same thing in OWA Mini. ActiveSync policies don't apply. This is not ActiveSync. There's no relation whatsoever, other than the fact that it's built for devices. That's the only similarity. And as I mentioned, this works in all OWA languages. That's really one of the key differences here. With the old OMA, we had a very small subset of languages that were supported. So how does it work? Like I said, I was a developer in Exchange for a while. I'm a geek. I like to know how things work behind the scenes. So when Service Pack 2 came out, one of the first things I did when I was aware of this feature was go install it on a machine, see how it was configured, and then go look at the source code and actually figure out what was going on behind the scenes. So what happens? If you go open up the IIS manager and look after you've installed Service Pack 2 at how this is configured, you'll see that it's configured exactly the same way as an OWA virtual directory. Looks exactly the same. Same directory, same everything. Same code that it's pointing to. There's no difference. With one exception, and that is, out of the box, this uses basic authentication instead of forms based auth. It's really the only difference. When this application starts up, so the first time a user actually goes to servername/OWA/OMA, which is, by default, how you get to OWA Mini, the application in ASP.NET will start up. It'll go look at where it's running, and it'll say, oh, I'm OMA. I'm not OWA, so I'm going to use these other forms. It's the same code that runs OWA It's just going into a different mode based on what that virtual directory is. That's the only difference. So that allows us to maintain this in a much better way moving forward, and you know, give it the attention that it deserves versus that separate application that we had in Exchange 2003. So that's OMini. I'm going to briefly touch on the hybrid configuration wizard, and I'll explain why I'm not going into detail in just a second. So the hybrid configuration wizard is a feature that we're extremely excited about. I'll tell you why. We found a lot of interest with our customers in trying out our cloud services, not moving everything to the cloud, trying out our cloud services. Or we've also seen a lot of interest in customers who want to have a certain segment of their user population in the cloud where they don't have to worry about it. You know, it's a fixed price, big storage, but there is less of a concern about where that data actually lives, and then still have a subset of their users on premises under your control. The data is, you know, under your own roof. Anyone here actually deployed hybrid with Office 365? A few? Okay. So the old way of doing that was extremely painful. I'm one of the few people who's had that experience. This talks about, you know, around 49 steps, a big checklist of things that you had to do to get this up and running properly. Very painful process. And really, any of those steps in that process could go wrong. And sometimes you knew that they'd gone wrong, and sometimes you didn't until you actually got to the end of the checklist, realized you had to start over from the beginning. So very hard to get right, and that's why we invested in this wizard. So what the wizard does is take those 49 steps to around 6 steps and does a bunch of validation in that process as well to make sure that things are properly configured, and when you're done with the process, it'll just work. That's the goal. So the reason I'm not going into great detail is that we actually have an entire session here on the hybrid wizard and how to configure hybrid. That's the EXL 303 session, which I believe is Wednesday, 2:45 p.m. Highly encourage you to go check that out if you're the least bit interested in Office 365 and deploying at least some of your mailboxes in the service. It's a great tool. So now we'll talk about address book policies for a little while. So anyone in the room ever deployed GAL segmentation with any release of Exchange? Okay, a few of you. So I'm going to explain what GAL segmentation is and some history of where GAL segmentation came from and why it's not a great thing. So in Exchange, the global address list is effectively a list of all of the objects in Active Directory that Exchange is going to use, all of your recipients, all of your mail-enabled objects. Right? So if I go open the global address list of Microsoft, it's a huge list of rooms, people, distribution lists, contacts, very, very large list. Right? Some people don't like having a large list like that, and there can be many reasons for it. Performance could be one. You know, we've done a lot of work to ensure that from a performance perspective, we can have a very large GAL, and Exchange will work just fine. But some people have run into performance problems. Maybe there's, you know, custom third-party applications that are accessing the GAL in some way other than the way Outlook does it, and they might run into performance issues. Some people have legal or compliance reasons for not wanting to have everyone visible in the global address list. You might have a scenario with what we call ethical walls, for instance, where you have a portion of your business that's not allowed to talk to another portion of your business. Maybe a financial company where you have stock traders and commercial bankers, and they're not allowed to contact each other. We have ways within the Exchange product that you can actually put up walls between those people. But in some cases, we've gotten feedback from customers that not only do they not want to allow those messages to pass through the system, maybe you're doing that with transport rules or something, but they don't want users to even be able to see that those other people exist. No visibility whatsoever. Well, GAL segmentation is one way to do that. You can actually restrict the visibility of users in the GAL. to subsets of other users. And the other, arguably most common reason for doing this is hosting. You want to build a hosting platform, but you don't want an exchange organization for every one of your hosting customers. Certainly, hosters that are hosting very small organizations wouldn't want to have to deploy a set of exchange infrastructure for, you know, every one of their 10 or 15 or 20 user organizations. That's not cost effective. It doesn't make sense. So instead, you want to deploy one organization, yet ensure that the people in those different tenants can't actually see each other. They shouldn't know that they're actually sharing infrastructure, maybe with their competitor, right? You never want to have that crossover occur. So that's why people segment GALs. So let's talk about a little bit of history here. In Exchange 2000, we actually created a knowledge base article that described how to do this in fairly good detail, using some security settings within Active Directory and a few tweaks within the Exchange product. And it sort of worked, sort of. Shortly after that, we released a solution called Hosted Messaging and Collaboration. Anybody here use HMC? Okay, a few of you. HMC was really designed to be the Microsoft-supported hosting platform for Exchange and SharePoint, provided provisioning infrastructure that allowed integration with billing systems and such things, and kind of automated the process of GAL segmentation. So it was a very well-supported, very well-documented, mostly very well-documented solution for doing exactly this. And so once that was available, we pulled the knowledge base article because we wanted people to deploy HMC. In Exchange 2003, we kind of figured that the problem was solved with the HMC solution, so we didn't bother publishing any documentation, but we got a bunch of support cases, and our support costs were pretty high because of this. And then in 2007, we learned from that and said, okay, well, we actually do need to document this. One of our support engineers, Dave Goldman, went off and wrote a white paper that explained how to do this in a semi-supportable manner, kind of like what the knowledge base article was that we'd done in 2000. What I'm trying to get across is that we've never really done a great job of providing one solution and one very straightforward way to do this in a way that the product team maintains and that was really engineered into the product, right? We didn't really learn from our mistakes until the 2010 product came around. So in 2010, we actually introduced hosting mode. And hosting mode actually gives you the kind of directory layout that we use internally in Office 365 for deploying a multi-tenant solution. We had some problems with hosting mode that I'll describe in a couple of slides. And that's why we've actually finally released address book policies, which we think is a much more supportable way to get this functionality. So in 2010, we do have actually two options that are built into the product, hosting mode and address book policies, that let you segment GALs. They're actually tested within our product team test processes. They're fully supported by Microsoft support, which is great. And they're meeting the needs that we have heard from you. So we're pretty happy with both of them. I'm going to explain why we want you to use one instead of the other in a minute or two. But first, I'm going to go through a little bit of detail about address book policies and how they're different than what we've done previously. So in the previous solutions, I mentioned that they were primarily focused on setting security attributes in Active Directory, setting ACLs to limit access to things. We also had so that actually works for Outlook, and it works for Exchange Active Sync, but it didn't work for OWA. So for OWA, we had to go in and adjust an attribute called the MSX query based DN that defines what portion of the directory an OWA user can see, with no kind of overlap between those ACLs that you set to limit Outlook and Exchange Active Sync. Very complicated configuration, very easy to get things wrong. And then for OABs, that was a whole other set of configuration that you had to do to make sure that users were not getting OAB data that didn't apply to their situation. So, address book policies, how do they actually help this? So ABPs, much like other policies that you have in Exchange, very similar concept to OA mailbox policies or any of the other policies that you can set, work on the concept of assignment to users. And the assignment that you're making with an address book policy is the assignment of a global address list, other address lists, a room list, and an offline address book to a user. So you could think of this as if you're hosting a multi-tenant solution, for example, each tenant might have an address book policy, and all of the users associated with that tenant would be assigned that policy. Much simpler than having to go through and manipulate, you know, three or four attributes in AD and a bunch of access control lists on each of those users. Much easier to audit, much easier to secure, much easier to ensure that you get right. So ABPs only work for users with mailboxes on Exchange 2010 SP2, frankly, because they actually are managed by the kind of common address book code that exists on Exchange 2010. For Outlook, that's the address book service that runs on CAS. For all the other workloads, that's kind of a shared bit of code that they all rely on to get access to Active Directory. So you have to make sure that the clients that are being used are actually going through those layers of code. And there are some scenarios that address book policies don't work with, and I'll talk through those in a second. Important to be aware of that if any of your users are actually using those other access methods. So really, any request that comes through that common code is going to be evaluated for address book policy assignment before a user is actually shown any directory information. So to show you a picture of how this works, we have a user over on the left, and we're assigning him an address book policy. That address book policy lists a set of address lists, a default address list, or a GAL, the room address list that user can see, and an offline address book. That user will not be able to see anything that's not included in those lists of objects. There's a set of directory objects down here at the bottom, some of which are included in that address book policy, some of which aren't. So the ones that aren't are not visible. So as an example of things that are impacted, things that actually do work with address book policies, if a user goes into Outlook, opens the address list picker, you know, maybe I click on the to button while I'm addressing a message and I get that address list picker, lets me select objects, that will absolutely be impacted here. That will be limited by my address book policy. If I try and resolve a name, I type a name in the to line, for instance, within Outlook or within OWA, and I hit the resolve names button, or the key combo that lets me do that. If that user is in my address book policy, it'll resolve. If not, it'll look like an external user, right? If I typed in the SMTP address, it would stay as an SMTP address. It wouldn't actually change to the full name of the user. If I go and want to add a room to a meeting request, if I go look at the list of rooms that are available to me in Outlook 2010 and try and pick one of those rooms, or if I let Outlook actually help me pick a room based on what's available in the time frame that I've specified, that's actually going to be filtered based on the room list that's assigned to my address book policy. Any searches against the GAL? So DL memberships are a special caveat here. So if I go in and look at the membership of a DL, that will absolutely be filtered. Absolutely. So I can't go in and, you know, go browsing through DLs to discover whether or not I'm actually in a multi-tenant hosted situation and discover that my competitor is actually running in the same system. DL membership absolutely is hidden based on address book policies. But this does not impact transport. So I could actually be sending mail when I send to a DL to people that I'm not expecting to send to. If a DL contains me and 50 other people in the room, my address book policy might show only me when I go and look at the membership in Outlook. but it'll go to all 51 people that are actually on that DL. So it does not impact transport at all. Mail tips may also appear to not be telling the truth. Mail tips will actually say, hey, you're about to send to a DL that has 51 people on it. And you go look at the DL membership, wait, there's only one person on it. Well, mail tips actually is telling you the truth. And it's important to remember that there are actually other ways within Exchange 2010 that you can have DLs that don't actually display the full list of users that you're going to be sending to, right? You can have hidden DL membership. There are ways to do that. So when we were trying to decide whether or not the right thing to do here was to actually have transport limit based on ABPs or to actually send to all users, we felt that this was actually the right call. You may or may not agree, but this is the way it is, so it's important to be aware of how this works. Your users may be a little confused by it. So that's the background. So let's talk a little bit about how you might actually set this up in a visual manner. So I'm going to go through three main scenarios here. So the first is two independent companies that I want to have within the same exchange organization. Maybe these are small companies that share an IT organization. And because they're small, it doesn't make sense to actually spread them out, have their own Active Directory forests, their own set of domain controllers, their own CAS, mailbox, et cetera. We want to just have one organization, pay for one set of infrastructure, one set of IT support staff, and get much better cost efficiency out of that. So we've got two companies, Fabricam and Tailspin. So within these two companies, each one has a set of users and DLs. Each one has a set of contacts that those users commonly communicate with outside the organization. And each one has a set of room mailboxes. These could be physically separate organizations, physically separate offices with their own set of conference rooms. You don't want people in Tailspin booking the conference rooms for Fabricam. Wouldn't make sense. So in terms of exchange configuration, we have address lists for each one of these sets of directory objects. An address list for users and DLs for both organization, contacts, and rooms. We also have GALs, global address lists, for Fabricam and for Tailspin, and an OAB for both of them as well that's associated with those global address lists. So when we go to set up address book policies, and by the way, out of the box by default, there's effectively an address book policy that provides everyone access to everything, right? So this really only comes into play when you go and create your first sort of non-default address book policy and assign it to users. So what we've done here is create two address book policies, one for Fabricam and one for Tailspin, and associated those address book policies with the lists that are appropriate for each organization. Then we associate those address book policies with the users, and from that point forward, those users can only see the directory objects that are appropriate for them. So let's complicate things a little bit. Now we have a shared CEO between these two companies. Call him Big Boss. Say this is actually, Microsoft, and we want to isolate the Xbox organization from the rest of Microsoft and keep Xbox sort of like a startup company. The rest of Microsoft has visibility into the rest of Microsoft. Xbox only has visibility into Xbox. But everyone is managed by Steve Ballmer. And Steve Ballmer needs to see everyone, and everyone needs to be able to see up to Steve Ballmer, but not across. That's the key. So in this case, we'll go and create a new address book policy for Big Boss and give Big Boss everything. Right? That address book policy has all of the address lists, the default GAL for Exchange, which contains everything, the default all rooms list, which contains all the rooms, and the default OAB. So at this point, all the users in Tailspin will be able to see Big Boss. All the users in Fabricam can see Big Boss, and Big Boss can see everything. So we've configured that in a single exchange organization. There you go. So, more complex. And this is actually arguably the reason that we created this feature. In Office 365, we actually have a large number of educational institutions. And we've certainly seen a lot of educational institutions deploying Exchange on premises. Anyone here from a school or university? A few? Okay, good. So there's a lot of very interesting scenarios around who can see directory objects within educational institutions. It tends to be more restrictive in the younger grades. And that's the example that I'm going to provide here. It gets a little more open when you get a little older. But in this particular case, I'm going to describe a deployment scenario where we have two classes of students. And the restriction is that students who are in those classes are not allowed to see each other, see the other classes, basically. They can see the principal, they can see all the teachers, but a student that's in class A is not allowed to see a student that's in class B. They can only see students that are in the same class. This is actually very easy to configure with address book policies. So we have basically three sets of objects here, right? We have students that are in the classes, we have teachers, which consist of the faculty, and we have the principal. So how would we configure that? First thing we do is go and create address lists for all the classes, right? Class A and a Class B address list. We can go and filter that based on some directory attribute that's coming from our provisioning system. Maybe we have, I don't know, class numbers or something that goes into one of the custom attributes in AD. We go and configure an all teachers address list. Maybe we have titles in Active Directory, so we filter based on title. We go and configure an all students address list. Maybe their title is student. Fairly easy to filter on that. And we go and configure an all groups address list. So for students who are in Class A, all we do is create an address book policy that limits them to the Class A address list, the all teachers address list, and the all groups address list, and the global address list for Class A. So if they go and actually browse the directory, students who are in that class, this is what they'll see. They'll see three members who are in Class A, and that's basically student one, teacher A, and the principal. Right? Those are the relevant directory users for Class A. If they go and look in Class B, in that group, say, the address list picker in Exchange, or in OWA or Outlook, what will they see? They'll see the teacher in Class B, and they'll see the principal, but they won't see any students, because they're not allowed to. They don't actually have that Class B address list in their address book policy. If they go look at everyone, they'll see everyone but the students in Class B. And in the faculty group, they'll see all the faculty. So the principal, we want to be able to see everyone. So for address lists, we assign the Class A address list and the Class B address list and all of the other address lists that, that everyone else has access to, and a gal that we've created for the principal that has all of those objects in it. So if the principal goes and actually browses these groups, the principal will see everyone that principal should have access to. Sees all of the members of Class A, all the members of Class B. Everyone is actually everyone. And faculty is still the same, right? All the teachers and the principal. So in terms of deployment considerations, it's really important to understand how these are configured, how they work, and how they don't work. More important to understand how they don't work. And to understand that when you're thinking about a multi-tenant hosted, in quotes, solution, ABPs don't actually provide everything you need for hosting. It's very important to remember. So there are ways to get around this. I talked about transport sending to all the members of a DL, even though you don't see all the members of a DL. That's just one example of how this doesn't provide true multi-tenancy. I'll talk about considerations for multi-tenancy in a second. But this is really more about optimizing address lists and providing a better user experience in terms of browsing the directory and making sure that your users can see what you want them to see or what they should be allowed to see versus actually implementing a true separated system. So I mentioned earlier that there are some workloads that this will not apply to. Anyone here use Mac, Outlook, or Entourage? Few? Okay, so those products browse the directory by connecting directly to an Active Directory domain controller. They use LDAP. Active Directory does not contain any knowledge of how address book policies should be applied to views of the address book. And because of that, if you go directly with LDAP to an Active Directory domain controller, you're going to see everything. There's no way around that. So what we typically see is that customers will try and disable LDAP access to their directories in order to ensure that users aren't doing that. And that can have a less than desirable end user impact in that you won't be able to browse the GAL from Mac Outlook or Entourage anymore. You will, however, in Mac Outlook, be able to resolve names. Some people think that that's okay. It's an okay trade-off in not being able to fully browse the GAL, but at least being able to make sure that you're getting the correct address in there. So just be aware of that. LDAP will not be impacted by address book policies. The other thing to be aware of is that if you're installing Exchange on global catalog servers, anybody do that? Good. Don't have to talk to anyone after class. That's good. If you do install Exchange on a global catalog server, or to be specific, if you install the Exchange client access server role on a global catalog server, the address book service that's responsible for providing that view of the directory to Outlook doesn't actually run. Instead, Outlook will connect to code that's provided by the Active Directory feature within Windows. And so because of that, address book policies won't take effect there either. So don't deploy CAS or really any Exchange role on GCs for a number of reasons. But specific to this, you don't want to deploy it because address book policies won't really work for Outlook users. If you actually are using distribution lists and you're deploying address book policies and you let your users manage distribution lists in Exchange Control Panel, which a lot of people are doing in Exchange 2010, now that they have the ability to not have to force people to call the help desk or deploy some other third-party product to manage distribution list creation and change processes. If you are combining that with address book policies, you need to be aware that the view of distribution lists in Exchange Control Panel is not impacted by address book policies. So the way to get around that, or the way to deal with that, is for users who are in the state of needing to manage distribution lists, if they're going to do that for distribution lists that span address book policies, you may want to disable their ability to manage those groups in ECP. That's the best recommendation we have for that right now. The other thing to be aware of is that if you are running GAL segmentation today, don't try and mix and match it with address book policies. It's not going to work very well. It's actually probably going to be a dismal failure. There is a process for migrating that we've documented fairly well on the web, but you need to follow that pretty carefully. Otherwise, you're liable to run into some challenges here. And last but not least, I hate having to go through all these things that don't work, but it is what it is at the moment. So if you are in that hybrid scenario, there were a few hands that got raised earlier for people who are running with some users on premises and some users in the cloud. If you're in that state, address book policies might be a little painful. We don't actually have address book policies in Office 365 today. So if you deploy them on premises and you have some users in the cloud who have an address book policy applied, they're going to see everything, regardless of what that policy is that you applied to them. There's some reasons for that, and I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail on it, but let's just say that it's a very complex thing to make that work in Office 365 in terms of the directory synchronization. And the other problem, in all honesty, is that for us to deploy address book policies in Office 365, we want it to work well with Link and SharePoint. Right, there's no point in limiting directory access on Exchange in Office 365 when you're probably going to deploy Link as well, as an example. And then all of a sudden, over here in your Link client, you can now resolve everything in your organization from a directory perspective, even though you're limited in Outlook. That's a really bad user experience. So we need to figure out internally how to make that work. We need to continue making friends with the Link team and getting that integration right. Same thing with SharePoint. Once we do that, we'll have this in Office 365 and a great Better Together story. So hosting mode. Don't use it, in a nutshell. Anybody out there actually deployed hosting mode? A few? OK. So we have some challenges with hosting mode. And we changed our guidance on hosting mode when we released Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2 to encourage people to not deploy it. And here's why. Customers that deployed hosting mode generally gave us feedback that they were unhappy with the limitations of hosting mode. Things like the inability to use public folders, the lack of support for unified messaging. Those are just a couple of examples. There are a number of limitations of things that you can't do with hosting mode. And because of that, not a lot of people deployed it. And because not a lot of people deployed it, every time we went to go decide whether or not we wanted to invest in adding something to it, the obvious decision happened, right? Well, nobody's using it, so why are we going to spend resources there versus spending resources on the core product that everyone is deploying and that everyone wants fixes for? So kind of a nasty cycle that we got into there. And because of that, what we've decided is that hosting mode is deprecated officially. We've announced that we're not going to make any further changes to hosting mode. It's still totally supported, right? If you have a problem with hosting mode, you can still call into Microsoft support. We will still fix issues with it. We're just not going to improve it at all. Any of those limitations that are in there today are always going to be limitations in hosting mode. We've also announced that hosting mode will not exist in the next version of the product that we're actively building right now. So we highly encourage you to not use hosting mode. So if you are a commercial hoster, or if you have another reason to deploy something like hosting mode, our recommendation is to use address book policies and some of the other technologies that we have built into the product in cooperation with some third-party hosting solution providers that we've done work with to build verified, tested solutions that that Microsoft and the third party will jointly support that actually provide a complete end-to-end hosting solution package. And we have some documentation on the web, actually at this URL, that describes each one of those hosting partners that we've worked very closely with. We've gone through their solution. We've gone through everything that they're doing within their product in terms of how they're configuring Exchange to make sure that it's happening in a supportable way. The other thing that we've done is, on that same website, released all the guidance that we provided to those third-party providers so that if you, for whatever reason, want to build your own solution, you can. And if you're abiding by the guidelines in that document, you will have a supported solution. Or if you want to become one of those third-party providers, there's also details on how to do that and how to get in touch with us to get that product actually reviewed and approved. So, once again, hosting mode totally supported through the lifecycle of Exchange 2010. We recommend that you don't use it as strongly as we possibly can. Can I ask you to save questions until the end? I'll definitely get to you, though. So with that, I'm going to talk briefly about OAuth cross-site silent redirection. We'll cover one of the new update roll-up features, and then I'll move into questions. So cross-site silent redirection is one of those things in the product that I'm kind of embarrassed about. Frankly, it's a really obvious solution to a problem that never should have been there to begin with. But we finally fixed it, finally made the product work the way it should have from the very beginning. So why do you want this? Why do you care? How many of you have more than one Active Directory site with CAS servers today? Okay, quite a few. So here's the scenario. Prior to Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2, let's say I'm a Microsoft user, and my mailbox is in Redmond, and Microsoft happens to have servers in other sites throughout the world. I have a few other sites that we use for redundancy purposes, site resiliency purposes, as well as trying to host data as close to users as we possibly can for a better end-user experience. Well, if I go to the wrong CAS, the wrong CAS, in quotes. Well, I'm going to get a message back from Exchange saying, bad user, you went to the wrong site. Your mailbox isn't hosted here. You shouldn't do that. Here's the right site. Go there. So not only did I get a scolding from Exchange that I went to the wrong place, I also have to log in again. I already gave Exchange my credentials for it to tell me that I went to the wrong place. Now I have to log in again. It's not very nice. So that's the scenario that we wanted to avoid. And in this particular scenario, basically what we're trying to enable is essentially single sign-on or optimized sign-on for users whose mailboxes have, for whatever reason, ended up in another site. You may have activated mailbox copies in the other site. They may be traveling and got geo-load balanced to some place that they, you know, where their mailbox isn't actually located. There's a whole lot of scenarios where this can happen. We just wanted to make this a much smoother process. So let's talk about how this works and how it's configured. So it's this disabled by default. We actually know that some people like this the current or the previously current behavior, the, you know, the scolding message and telling people where they should be going and to update their internet favorites. So we didn't want to just, you know, change that behavior by default when you install Service Pack 2. We wanted this to be a decision that you make, that you're making for your users and the you know, the doing the right thing for your company or your organization. So out of the box, manual redirection, the old way, is what you get. If you are using forms-based authentication for OAuth and securing it with SSL, this will work. It's only available for intra-org redirection. In other words, this doesn't work if you're using hybrid with Office 365. This is only intra-org. Very important to remember that. So to enable it, very simple. Set OAuth virtual directory as of Service Pack 2 has a new parameter to that commandlet, which is the cross-site redirect type. Silent is the option you want if you want to enable this. You can set it back to manual if you want. And it will warn you when you do that. It'll tell you that, you know, you need to have an external URL set, basically a place that we're going to redirect to, and you need to have forms-based authentication enabled. So what does this actually look like? So the old experience. I log into my Redmond site, and I go ahead and put my credentials in, and what happens? Well, I get a page. That's the scolding page telling me, well, yeah, your mailbox isn't actually in Redmond. It's in London. I don't know why it's in London. My administrator seems to have, you know, done some sort of magic behind the scenes to activate a mailbox copy, or maybe my mailbox got moved. Who knows? But as a user, I now know that my mailbox is in London, and next time I should go directly there. Until the next time my mailbox gets moved or a copy gets activated, then maybe I'll be back to Redmond. So I click on that link. And I get to the login page in London. So I type my credentials in again. Hopefully I get them right. And I should actually get access to my inbox. Awesome. So that's kind of nasty. So after I go to Redmond, I type in my credentials. What happens? I get my mailbox. Very simple. That's the way it should have worked from the beginning. And that's the way it works now. So there you go. Cue applause. A few. Thank you. So let's talk briefly about how it works. Like I said, I'm a geek. I like to know how things work behind the scenes. So if OAuth determines that we can do this, that if we're using forms-based auth, that if we have external URLs set up properly, if all of the stars are aligned, if we can do this, all we do is basically do exactly what we do out of the box with Exchange 2010 if we're performing this behavior to a legacy server. Right? So with Exchange 2010, we provided the ability to do this single sign-on if your mailbox was still on an Exchange 2007 server. We just didn't provide it for the Exchange 2010 case. So the way it works is that instead of sending that scolding page that tells you where your mailbox really is, we just send some HTML to your browser that contains a form, basically the logon form, but hidden, with the credentials that you provided to us, and a target of the other server that we want you to go to. and a little bit of JavaScript in there that says, when the page loads, submit the form. Trivial, right? Very easy. If JavaScript isn't enabled in the browser, obviously it won't work. But frankly, it won't work either. So hopefully that's not a problem. But yeah, very simple implementation, and it just works. So we're going to talk briefly about the latest update rollup, which we unfortunately call RU. Should be UR, because they're not updates of rollups. They're, well, rollups of updates. But anyway, so we're calling them update rollups, or RU. The latest one is number 3. So in update rollups, we typically are just fixing bugs. Right? We have a normal cycle that we go through of fixing issues that come in from customers, come in from the field, and that we found in our online service. These are things that we think have broad applicability, that you're very likely to hit. We don't do a lot of them in an update rollup. There's usually maybe 40 or 50 bug fixes. It's a fairly low number. And it's a number that we feel that we can test pretty thoroughly within our quality assurance process before we do a release. We're constantly raising the bar on that quality assurance process, getting better and better about avoiding what we call regressions. Basically, taking a step back and making something not work that it used to. That's a regression. We want to avoid that at all costs. So we're constantly tuning things in the product. Some of these things are bug fixes, like I mentioned. Some of them are tweaks for performance, scalability, et cetera. And typically, when we come up with one of our larger sort of tune-ups, you'll actually see that documented on the Exchange Team blog. Everyone here familiar with the Exchange Team blog and reads it regularly? That's really the primary way that the Exchange engineering team communicates with our customers today. We love the comments that we get on the blog. We love publishing information there. It's a great, highly effective way for us to stay in touch. So those of you that aren't familiar with it, highly encourage you to add it to your favorite RSS reader. Read it religiously. There's a lot of great information published there. So you'll see documentation typically right after we publish a new update rollup about the tune-ups that are there. And I'm going to talk about one of them now. So a little bit of background. In Exchange, for many years, we've had this concept of the dumpster. The dumpster is an area within the Exchange database where we keep things that have been deleted that we don't want to really delete. Exchange hates to delete information. We love to hang on to data as long as we possibly can. So just in case you're not aware, when you delete something in Outlook, say you're in your inbox, you hit the delete button on your keyboard, mail goes into deleted items, right? So not really deleted. Still in your mailbox. You can still get to it in deleted items. But now you go empty your deleted items folder. It's gone, right? No. It's in the dumpster in Exchange. And we will keep it there for some period, usually of days. Could be longer, could be shorter. It's configurable on the server, where it can be recovered. And that's a good thing. You want people to potentially recover single items on their own without having to go to backup, which can be very time-consuming and costly. So dumpster is a great thing. In Exchange 2010, we created what we call Dumpster 2.0, or the Recoverable Item Store 2.0, and we added some features that use that. A lot of our compliance and discovery features utilize this area of the mailbox. Once again, it's a hidden portion of a user's mailbox where we store deleted items, but we also store versions of content. This is really the major change that came in Exchange 2010. And by versions of information, what I mean is that when a user goes and edits information in their mailbox, we'll do what we call copy on write. So we'll store a copy of the old content prior to editing in the recoverable item store, and then we'll save the edited copy in the mailbox. So that means that users can go and could have historically gone and edited information in their mailbox, and it wouldn't have been discoverable, right? If I went and did a multi-mailbox compliance discovery search, I wouldn't have actually seen that content change. I would only see the kind of the final version of that content. In 2010, all of those individual changes are preserved, with a couple of caveats. We don't do it for the drafts folder because we don't want the kind of the constant churn that happens within the drafts folder, bloating that mailbox database. So we noticed a problem with this technology that we realized we needed to change post-Service Pack 2. And that problem is that if you have items that are outside of the drafts folder, particularly with attachments that are getting edited, that you can end up with a huge bloat in your database files. Some of you may have experienced this. It's kind of painful, hard to size for in particular, as your databases grow and grow and grow in ways that you weren't anticipating when you deployed your storage. So the scenario here is I have a calendar item that was sent to me with some attachments. So I go and I open the item and I open the attachment. The moment I do that, Outlook is going to be a good citizen and with my best interests in mind, start to autosave, like all of the Office products that we have out there today, right? They autosave on a regular schedule to make sure that if something bad happens, you preserve data, right? If program crashes or if, you lose power, whatever, you've got data preserved. Well, that's great, and it's also a problem for Exchange. So every time Outlook is autosaving, it's saving the item, which we're doing a copy on write for, and it's also saving the attachments separately. So let's say I have a message or a calendar item with 15 attachments that are 15 megs each. Every 3 minutes, I'm going to save the entire set of that content multiple times, where multiple times equals the item plus the number of attachments. And I'm going to preserve that for the duration that I've set for content to be stored in the recoverable item store, which might be weeks, might be months. If a user's on litigation hold, might be forever. Huge problem. So what we did in this update rollup, frankly, it's very minimal change from your perspective, fairly significant change from our perspective. But what we did was just change this so that the only thing that we're doing is storing one copy of that change and optimizing this fairly significantly. So rather than storing each one of those attachments and the item itself, we're just saving the entire package once on that 3 minute update interval. So you still will see some database growth for this scenario, but significantly less. So that's one example of the types of tune-ups that we're constantly adding in update rollups, and one of the reasons that we want you, as much as possible, to deploy these update rollups in your own topologies. Obviously, we also want you to test them first. Everybody here has a lab environment or maybe a virtual machine on a laptop where they can test things prior to deploying in production, right? That's definitely a best practice. And something you should do before deploying really any enterprise software, anything that's going to impact your business. Highly recommend you do that. But stay as current as you can on Exchange. That's the best practice. So with that, I've got almost 15 minutes for questions, but I am going to point you to a few related sessions. So Scott Schnoll tomorrow is going to do a session on Service Pack 2 tips and tricks. This is always a very well-received session, and he'll go through some of the issues that we've seen in the field lately around Service Pack 2, some of the ways that you can deal with those issues, and he'll talk about some of the new things that we've released in terms of support tools and techniques for keeping your Service Pack 2 servers in tip-top shape. I also mentioned the hybrid exchange session with the hybrid configuration wizard. That'll be on Wednesday as well in the afternoon. Highly recommend you attend that. I do want to mention, I'm going to flip quickly through this, that if you are interested in Exchange 15, I really wish that I could talk to you today about Exchange 15, because it's something I've been working on personally for a few years now. But we're unfortunately under some pretty strict guidance about our ability to talk about it here. Basically, we're not allowed to talk about it here at all. But if you are interested in Exchange 15, this is going to be the first event where you can get very in-depth information about the next release of Exchange. The vast majority of the content delivered at the Microsoft Exchange Conference at the end of September will be around Exchange 15. And you'll have an opportunity to talk directly to folks like me, as well as component team program managers and developers, the folks who actually went through the process of engineering the product and making the decisions about what went into the product. So if you are interested, highly encourage you to attend this. It's going to be a great session. So with that, I will encourage you to submit your evals, and I'm more than happy to take questions. There was one over here around hosting, I believe. Yep. Yep. Okay, so the question was, given that we've announced that hosting mode is deprecated in Service Pack 2, what's the guidance for what replaces that? And what can I talk about coming in Exchange 15? So the guidance for replacing that is what I went through at a high level in the deck, which is we have a solution guidance program in cooperation with some third-party vendors where we have entire end-to-end solutions that the product team has gone through and approved that we've deemed to be fully supportable for deploying a multi-tenant Exchange solution. And those don't utilize hosting mode. They utilize just a normal deployment of Exchange. They can allow you to upgrade from HMC in place in the same forest, unlike hosting mode. You can deploy public folders. You can deploy unified messaging. All those limitations that came with hosting mode are really thrown out. You can really deploy the entire Exchange stack with those solutions. Around the Exchange 15 part of the question, like I said, I can't really talk about details around Exchange 15, but we have specifically announced that Exchange 15 won't have hosting mode. I think it's fair to expect that the investment that we've made around the solutions program for Exchange 2010 is something that we plan to carry forward, but we're not going to go into details on that until we actually talk in more detail about the entire Exchange 15 product. Other questions? Yep. Public folders. Okay. Question is, public folders in Exchange 15? Can't tell you. I wish I could, but I can't. You're going to have to wait a little bit, but you will hear an answer at some point in the future. Is there a mech plan for Europe for Exchange 15? At the moment, the North American one in Orlando is the only one planned. I'm sure the individual who is the planner for MEC is also the track owner for Exchange, and he'll be down in the booth. So if you're interested in a European MEC, definitely provide that feedback down in the booth. We'd love to hear that. His name's Navin Chand. Yep. So. The question is, should RU3 bring down the database sizes due to the calendar attachment problem? I wouldn't necessarily expect it to reduce your database size just by installing it. So the challenge is that for that particular issue that I'm talking about, database size would have already been consumed. What you would see is a reduction moving forward in growth. Yeah. Yeah, so Exchange doesn't actually shrink databases, ever. You have to take databases offline, and there's ways to shrink them offline. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, other questions? No. So, yeah. So if you are running Link on premises, address book policies won't apply there either. Link does have if you go through the hosting mode guidance that we have in that solutions page, I believe we do point to a way to limit Link address book visibility. There is a way to do that. It's not quite as how can I put this? it's not quite as dynamic as address book policy. It's not quite as kind of flexible. But you can, you may be able to meet your requirement on premises. In the online service, what we're trying to do there is actually make things work just across the board with address book policies. And at the moment, we don't actually even expose the commandlet for configuring address book policies in Office 365. They just aren't there at all. So once we're able to kind of have that better together story, that's when we would want to make that available in the service. So if you feel free to come up and get my card, and I'm happy to help you with the link question offline. Yep. Mm-hmm. Cross-site silent redirection with, if you're doing cross-forest, so that's separate organizations, this only applies to intra-org redirection. So, yeah, it won't work in that scenario. Sorry about that. I'm going to take him and then I'll take you. Yep. Sure. So the question is about the problem with LDAP access with the Mac Outlook and Entourage clients and address book policies and whether there's a recommendation for how to get that to work. So the recommendation, frankly, is to disable LDAP access. And there's a number of ways you could do that. You have to be somewhat careful about how you do that because Exchange needs LDAP to be able to communicate with those domain controllers. But you could potentially put in some firewall rules that allow Exchange servers to get access but allow your clients to not. And if that's the case, Mac Outlook won't be able to browse the address book, but they will be able to resolve names. So you could have users have contacts locally for the set of users that they regularly communicate with. They'd be able to browse those locally. But there is no current way to have Outlook go through the same service that provides that filtered view of the directory. So the question is, will it have another impact on Mac Outlook with AutoDiscover? So AutoDiscover would not be. AutoDiscover would still work because you're hitting AutoDiscover on the Exchange server. The Exchange server has access to the domain controller. So we don't anticipate other negative impacts. We're not aware of any. We haven't seen any via testing. So. Sorry, say that again? Does OMNI work in Exchange Online? Yes, it does. So why would you choose? The question is, why would you choose OMNI if you have OWA? It really comes down to devices. So it's designed for browsers on these guys, and it's designed for specifically devices that are not, for whatever reason, going to work well with ActiveSync. Like I said, there's a particular market in the world, Japan specifically, where that tends to be the common way to access personal information manager type data, like you would find in Outlook, there may be reasons that you don't want ActiveSync to be enabled. We certainly see customers that, for whatever reason, have a multitude of devices, some of which work well with ActiveSync. Some devices work better than others from an ActiveSync perspective, and so some customers choose to disable ActiveSync or disable ActiveSync to a subset of devices. This would allow you to get in to your mailbox and access your data in a way that's optimized for a small device without, if you don't have the ability to use ActiveSync. That's really the scenario. Anybody else? All right. Oh, one more. Okay. Any forefront experts, forefront protection for Exchange experts in my team? Stop by the Exchange booth. I believe we have one person coming who has a fair amount of expertise with that. And if not, feel free to grab my business card in the booth, and I can hook you up with someone. Okay? Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.